In this episode, we speak with Bill Gibson, CEO of DePosco, a provider of cloud-based supply chain applications for retailers, distributors, 3PLs, and brand companies. DePosco's bright suite of omnichannel fulfillment supply chain applications allows fast-growing companies to rapidly scale their warehouse management and order management operations, so they can see what inventory they've got, where it is, and where to position it to fulfill demand. Bill first got his start in 1993 as an account executive at Manugistics. From there, he went on to grow Tech Ventures and then became a managing partner at the Albemarle Group. Bill was recognized as one of the top 50 SaaS CEOs of 2023 by the Software Report. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the managing partner of GrowthCap and the executive chairman of Market Insight Media. He is the host of Growth Investor, a podcast featuring today's best investors, executives, and founders. In the minutes ahead, we'll uncover insights and strategies for accelerating growth and succeeding in business.
Bill, thank you so much for taking the time. It's a delight to be with you today.
Thanks, RJ. Really a pleasure to finally get together and sort of have a nice conversation.
Excellent. So, you know, the supply chain space is one that many are looking at, and many have been looking at this space and maybe have invested in it. Where you play is particularly interesting, you know, given how prevalent online ordering, online shopping, e-commerce is. For the benefit of our audience, can you tell us specifically about the DePosco solution?
We are big believers in the digital economy, and that's a bit of a cliche term at this point. It's been much discussed, but when you look at numbers and you listen to leaders in the space like Amazon or Shopify, some well-known brands that serve this economy, they'll talk about 2 million merchants worldwide on their platform. And we have a thesis that, you know, out of these 2 million merchants, there will be a class of them that rise up into a greater scale. You know, many of these businesses are mom and pop shops, and maybe they won't scale, but there are entrepreneurs that are creating great new products, great new services, and bringing them to the market worldwide in a new channel. And we want to focus on that channel and serve that channel. The challenges those businesses have, whether they're more in the SMB category or middle market category or rising towards large cap enterprise class organizations, they have very common traditional supply chain management challenges. They need to understand their customers better. They need, in the modern world and the current economy, align their operations against their customers. Most of these brands are serving consumers, right? So it's a direct to consumer D2C type of motion. And what DePosco does is we have a suite of applications which helps our customers, principally these scaling, high growth, middle market brands that are aspirational to scale, to understand their customers, manage those customer orders as they flow in for a variety of goods, to understand what their inventory positions are, to manage their inventories, and then to execute orders such that their end customers, the consumers, get what they ordered. We've all had a poor experience where we ordered something online and it took a while to get there, or when it arrived, it wasn't quite what we ordered. You know, what we do is, you know, behind the scenes operations, working with the brands that ship those goods to you, provide those goods and sell those goods to you to make sure that those operations are flawless.
I've noticed, like, particularly around Black Friday, when presumably volumes like spiked, there were a lot more issues that were happening with these probably SMBs out there. I noticed it with my own ordering. Either things took longer, or the merchant didn't know that they didn't have certain items in stock. Is that happening? Because I imagine there's maybe a little bit of human error involved in that. Maybe someone's not tracking their inventory appropriately. Because if it's all run by systems, I would think the system's able to keep up.
I would orient towards a few observations. One observation is that the transportation infrastructure can't keep up with the growth of direct to consumer. Whether you're looking at major parcel carriers such as UPS or FedEx or USPS, right, to a degree, there's an infrastructure, right? There are distribution hubs, there are assets, trucks and drivers and so forth that are out making sure these parcels get to where they belong. And it seems like no matter how much investment these major entities make into their hubs and their trucks and their networks, they just can't keep up with the growth. So there's a bottleneck that happens and there's a challenge there, right? How much do we invest? Those brands, let's say, how much do they invest in the physical infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure before they get overextended? So that's, you know, that's one issue right there. I would say that, you know, another issue is we've seen a fair amount of risk in supply sides. That's more the transportation delivery side. But on the other end of the spectrum, the supply side, there's been a fair amount of uncertainty there and risk there that we've seen, certainly going back to, you know, 2020 and COVID and 2021, as we've come out of that, many supply chains were disrupted. Production was interrupted because folks couldn't be present to produce goods. I guess the furniture industry just feels like the space that was most impacted by that. But certainly across the board, there were major disruptions. And that still persists. It's 2023 going into 24. We're coming out of that. And supply side of the supply chains are coming back together. But there still is uncertainty and risk there. We've seen strikes in various ports of, you know, LA and Long Beach and Seattle over time. So that's the second factor. A third factor is, you know, unfortunately, many of the businesses that we end up buying from either directly online through their online stores, maybe built on Shopify or from a trusted marketplace like Amazon, we buy from these brands. We don't have full transparency, you know, who it's coming from. To some degree, we do. But many of these brands that are coming up, they haven't really made the investment that they could to keep up with the opportunity in front of them. So many of them are working on paper. Many of them have not really implemented a system like the POSCO to help them understand their orders, the optionality, drive some optimization into their picking, packing, shipping decisions, and so forth. And so the real question is, you know, which of those businesses, that's the part that they can control, right? You can't always control your service provider on the transportation side. If I speak for these, you know, these brands that are scaling up, you can't always control, you know, the supply side. You place your orders and you really are looking for those containers to come in, but you can control, you know, the four walls, if you will, of your operation. And some are making the investments to sort of play into the opportunity to scale up, and some are not. And that all plays into, you know, do we really know what our real available to promise, available to ship is right now? As you are, Jay, place an order online. The best brands that are aspirational and scaling up, they have a real-time synchronization between their ATP, ATS, and what their online store looks like or their marketplace position. That's some of what we see, those three factors.
Now, when we think about the macro picture and the growth of e-commerce, you know, I remember seeing charts about the penetration of e-commerce, you know, as compared to the broader market of retail purchases. And it was at the time, I think it was like a small percentage, it was like 15%. But I imagine that is continuing and has continued to increase. Do you still see kind of the same level of growth in the share that e-commerce has vis-a-vis the overall purchasing and environment? And then are you also seeing more traditional players shifting over more into e-commerce?
Well, we're all consumers, right? It's relatively easy to get your head around this without getting caught up in top-down market analysis, right? We're all consumers. And there are different types of goods that we purchase, different price points, different levels of urgency around the purchase, different considerations that we have. And there are preferences we have as individuals. So some of us like to go into the store for certain goods. Some folks like to shop online and look at what variety is out there, what price optionality there may be in the market. It's very rare for folks to follow at this day and age just a single channel experience as a shopper. I think we are all leaning in, whether it's on laptops or tablets or smartphones, iPhones, you name it, into a multi-sensory, multi-input method for shopping. And again, some goods are a more significant purchase, which requires maybe a little bit more research. Some goods are more frequent purchases, low pressure, low value. That trend is going to continue. Much was made of the retail apocalypse and things are falling apart. But stores are here to stay. They're not going away, right? It's as old as the ancient agora in, you know, in Greece, or the Turkish bazaar in Istanbul, Constantinople. There were evolutions, I guess, the shopping mall in the 1960s in Minneapolis, right, in Minnesota. So for certain goods and purchases, whether it's urgency or the need to see and interact, we're going to go to stores. That doesn't mean we'll always transact there, but that would be part of our decision-making process. And we will also be going online increasingly. especially as sort of there's a tremendous variety in price that you can see online, which gives you a better sense of value and potential on the purchase. And then you also have a perspective, right? Traditionally, you would go to friends, family, some close network on, hey, what do you think about product X? Now you have all these millions of strangers online that are going to weigh in, and there's some means of listening in indirectly to third-party conversations, you know, and opinions about items. I don't think any of that's going to change. I think it's going to be more converged in the future. I think that brands, if they're wise, will be offering up optionality there. We're seeing brands that have been traditional presence-driven sales, sort of call it in-store type sale transactions, move online increasingly. We've seen brands that are native online, born online, moving to, you know, physical locations. There's a reason for that. I mean, one of our customers is Cycle Bunny. They're a very well-known, high-growth men's fashion brand. We've been working with them for a few years. I think, you know, Todd shared with you that we've gotten some recognition around the work we've done with them. But an interesting data point that I got at one of our last customer advisory boards, inclusive of one of the executives at Cycle Bunny, was that they looked at their online sales to help them determine where it was more optimal to place their stores. And then they learned something more. After they were opening stores in areas that had online transactions, they noticed that consumers that were moving to multimodal purchasing, multi-channel purchasing, bought twice as often, right? There's something to that trend that I think other brands will flow into and offer that up to their customers.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit. Your path as an entrepreneur or as an executive was an interesting one, because it looked like you delved into maybe the investment side, the advisory side. And by the way, congratulations, as you know, being awarded a top 50 SaaS CEO of 2023. So this is kind of in line with kind of understanding a little bit more about how you've been able to succeed as an executive. But tell us about your background. It looks like you started out in corporate and then may have moved into venture and then back to the executive world.
Yeah, I like to joke I'm a second generation business software guy, right? You know, enterprise software guy. I don't know how many of us there are. I think a lot of parents that were part of, you know, first generation enterprise software through the 90s and early 2000s, there's a lot of scars that those entrepreneurs accrued as they built their brands and businesses. My father built one of the first supply chain management software companies, scaled it from essentially inception to, I think, about 2,000, you know, teammates, associates worldwide, serving the Fortune 2000, a couple billion dollar market cap, I think, you know, $2.5, $3 billion market cap when he eventually took it public and scaled it up. So I, as a Gen Xer, 52 years old, kind of at the crossroads, seeing a major platform shift from, call it, mainframe mini computer systems to client server as client server came up. And that was an education in and of itself, first generation enterprise software, first generation supply chain management. It wasn't called supply chain management in the early days. It was more logistics or manufacturing or transportation. And it really was more fragmented, but that space came together through the 90s and became recognized as supply chain management. So, you know, there was definitely formation there of seeing space play out, seeing technology play out, seeing businesses scale up. We think of these major enterprises as having always been the scale they are in 2023, but many of these businesses were much smaller in the 90s. And, you know, the brands that made the good decisions around technology to embrace it, make the most of it, they were the ones that scaled up. And those are the brand names we all know and we're familiar with. The businesses that had some scale in the 90s that didn't make the investment in technology, well, a lot of them we don't know, right? Because they didn't have the same opportunity to play into the scale. It's funny, right? Once upon a time, Walmart was a 27 store regional, you know, grocer, multi-goods retailer. And then it became Walmart. And then everybody wanted to be Walmart. So very blue collar background in my family. Dad was a self-made man, worked his way through college, found his way into what he ultimately did, and then scaled that business up. I got to witness it, and at some point in time decided, after, you know, years in that business on the delivery side, you know, working directly with customers and the business development side, both domestic and abroad, for a couple of years. I went back to business school, got into growth equity, venture capital growth equity, started to see the rise of cloud, or what's now called cloud. It was, you know, on-demand software, software as a service. Now everybody just thinks of it as cloud. And what connected the dots initially for me was, wow, I saw, call it mainframe mini computer to client server. That was a major platform shift. And that unlocked a lot of opportunity as a software company to introduce new capabilities. And my creativity just started to run once I started to think about cloud and the extensibility and single database potential. And that drove thinking around what we're doing at DePosco. So it was, you know, very much immersed in a creative entrepreneurial environment as I grew up, and ultimately couldn't resist the siren song to kind of get into what I'm currently doing now with DePosco.
And it looks like you may have funded the company in a very efficient manner, maybe, you know, partly bootstrapping it in the early years until you took a bigger check later on. Is that the case?
Yeah. So fortunately, I have a father that had some success and was a believer in his son, for better, for worse. And I'd had enough experience as a growth equity investor to see different focuses that, let's say, first-time CEOs or CEOs take. And when you build a business like DePosco, as a CEO, you can focus on sales, finding customers, driving some revenue, some traction. You can focus on a product and a platform. You could focus on the delivery, right, of that product, that service. What I saw a lot of CEOs do as a growth investor was focused on the sales side, the revenue side. And not to belittle that, but understandably, most of those entrepreneurs, CEO, first-time CEOs, they're trying to create optics, right? They're trying to drive some form of traction that they can bring to a set of investors to say, hey, I have an idea. Look, here's some traction. You know, please, you know, back me. Let's work together to scale something up. I do feel like that's not an ideal way to build a business, at least the way DePosco aspired to build a business. As a growth equity investor, I saw several businesses that followed that path, got to a certain point, and then were seeking funds. And when you really dug into why they were seeking funds, you would think, oh, maybe it's to drive sales, drive, you know, because, you know, maybe they were coming for investment when they had some baseline product, you know, 25 customers, 50 business customers, whatever it may be, a couple million dollars of ARR. And you would think, oh, they're looking to drive growth here. But unfortunately, many of those brands were struggling to scale beyond that initial wave of first customers. And when you really dug under the hood from a technology standpoint, call it a house of cards, right? A lot of them had teams that did some heroic work to put a product together, a platform together to serve the early customers, but it wasn't scalable. And so they were looking mid-flight to rebuild the plane, right? They were looking mid-flight to effectively rebuild their software for a forward path. So as we got DePosco started, I was really obsessed about the product. There was a clear long-term vision, called a 20-year plan. Maybe that's too much of a plan, but you know, there was more of a long-term vision and a path to get there over time. And I wanted to obsess on the product and platform side, because I never wanted to be in a position where I was out saying, hey, we have to rebuild the foundation. You want to have a really strong foundation. So we focused first on the product and the platform, drove product market fit, then moved to the second area, which was the delivery, right? Outcomes. We're in the outcomes business. So, you know, when we work with our customers, if they receive outcomes from working with us on our software and our services, then they're happy. If they implement our software and partake in our services, but they don't drive outcomes, they're not happy. Right. So the reality is, yes, we're a software company, but we're an outcomes company first and foremost. So our professional services team really helps to drive those outcomes. And it wasn't until later on, I mean, we managed great growth by focusing on the product and the delivery. And then we eventually turned more towards driving, you know, the sales motion, the marketing motion, and those areas there after the engine was built to really deliver at greater scale for our customers.
And then how did you go about selecting as your capital partner NewSpring? And tell us a little bit about the value that they bring to the table, not just the financial capital, but other capabilities.
Well, maybe I'll give you a little bit more background on the cap structure over time, right? Which played a significant role in choosing NewSpring as a partner. You know, it was a family office initial investment into the business, which then begot another family office who had curiosity and interest to partner with us in what we were doing at DePosco, which then led to a third family office. Now, all these family offices really stemmed from entrepreneurs and families that had success in initiating, scaling a successful business with a strong financial outcome. And I felt that was really important in the early years. So we had strong partnership around, you know, mid to long-term focus of what we wanted to be and the unique value that we wanted to bring to our customer base and sort of to society more broadly speaking by virtue of what we're doing. The challenge when you really start approaching certain institutional investors, and there was interest over time from institutional investors calling in, and you know, that's part of my job. I have an open door policy of really speaking to potential investors, folks curious about what we do, comparing notes on the market and so forth. But right, a lot of these institutions, right, they've got their LPs, they've got investment horizons, they've got returns. And unfortunately, some folks take a short-term view, right? They take a short-term view, or there's other factors there. I have a philosophy that, you know, it's all one team. You know, there's no such thing as company versus investors or management team versus board, right? It's all one entity. It's all DePosco in our case. We're all bright lights of DePosco. And so as I dealt with investors, really, there was a handful that started to stand out, folks that understood the space, folks that I thought were culturally aligned, values aligned. When we recruit new teammates, we look for alignment on purpose, mission, values, and an outcome orientation. And that's really the same methodology we approach when we're talking to potential investors, or as I'm talking to potential investors, are we aligned on those variables? Because if we're aligned, then you're going to have a lot of success. NewSpring in particular, as we got into a cycle in 2020 and what ultimately culminated in an investment in February of 2021, they got very side by side with us, right? Hart Callahan and his team, Mark Lederman, who's one of the founders of the fund, they got very side by side with us and they understood the products. They learned about our customers, the value that we provided, and all the typical mechanics. But then they really aligned on where we wanted to go as an organization. And they went very deep. They worked very hard. And we just built a lot of trust, I think, over the conversation that lasted, I don't know, probably about 6 months while we were talking to multiple investors until it sort of finally honed in on NewSpring. But what really stood out was the alignment on mission, purpose, values, outcomes. I wanted to make sure I understood what was good for them in terms of an investment and an outcome so that I could deliver that to them. And they got very side by side on problem solving, right? If we wanted to create a path forward over the next 3 years, 5 years, they worked with us, you know, on that. It wasn't like they were just asking us or the management team for all the answers. We engaged, we provided a lot of the materials, but we got side by side, modeled together, discussed how we were going to make, you know, those results happen. And that's what stood out with Hart and Mark and the rest of the team.
Excellent. We're coming up on time. I do have two final questions. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
It's going to be motherhood and apple pie. There's really two. There's my mother's father, my pop Izzo, and then my dad, who I mentioned a little bit earlier. You know, my pop came from, I guess, what Brokaw called the greatest generation. He had a hardscrabble childhood, a child of the Depression, kind of grew up through the Depression, made it work. When World War II broke out, he was in the Philadelphia Navy Yards helping to build ships. And, you know, as the war ended and development continued in the Philadelphia area, he was in construction helping to build the city of Philadelphia. After that, he got into logistics and driving trucks for the Philadelphia Inquirer. So he went from a driver, which was the newspaper of Philadelphia. He went from a driver to ultimately working his way up to the head of logistics and all the routes. He had memorized in the days before software, he had memorized all the routes and all the ways to get around and drop all the papers off. Pop really had a strong influence on me. Work ethic, values, just, you know, you name it. And then dad, you know, being the first to go to college and working his way through college, he drove trucks for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You know, that's kind of how he met mom, or, you know, through pop. And so they had gone to school together, but really, you know, it was kind of a small world event, you know, but dad sort of took some of that experience working in early manufacturing environments, copper at Philadelphia Copper and Brass, driving trucks for the Inquirer, to feed into his idea ultimately for Manugistics, which was, you know, the business he built and the supply chain space. So those two individuals had an incredible influence on my life.
Last question. Can you tell us about a charity cause or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
Sure. Well, I've got four children. My oldest is a special needs child. It's a daughter. And she's got a condition named Phelan-McDermid, which is a chromosomal deletion, right? It manifests from a chromosomal deletion as really she was coming into being. And so there are only a few thousand people on the planet. She's literally a one in a million child. She's a sweet girl, happy girl, you know, amazing daughter. And so, you know, watching her grow up, there was a great degree of uncertainty, right? How her life was going to be, who she was going to be as she grew up, and a lot of pressure, right? As a parent in that environment. And so I think you have a very personal experience with a special needs child with the condition, as rare as that, you lean into it. And I think what is really close to my heart are, you know, special needs children, and whether it's Phelan McDermid specifically, it's not quite in an autistic spectrum, but in the early years, it presented as such, and it felt like it was close in proximity to the autistic spectrum. So I've done certain things around Autism Speaks. I ran the Chicago Marathon, raised, you know, some money for Autism Speak, you know, did other things around that. I don't like to talk too much about, you know, what I do on that side. But I think special needs children, parents, right, of special needs children, we're not really, as a society, understanding or as understanding as I think we could be to parents. And then my second daughter is 12 years old, so only 3 years younger than her sister. And what's really challenging for siblings of special needs children is they don't always get the attention that the special needs child gets. And so I have a great degree of compassion and empathy, if you will, for the siblings of the special needs kids. Now, you see all these great stories of business leaders or athletes that are motivated by their special needs sibling. So that's where my heart is. You know, it's with special needs children, Phelan McDermid specifically, 22Q, you know, autistic, Autism Speak spectrum. With parents of special needs kids, I think society would do well to pay a little bit more attention to the challenge. It's incredibly challenging to raise a child, let alone one with needs. And then the siblings, you know, who sometimes can get overlooked. You know, I always made a point to spend a little bit of extra time with my 12-year-old as she grew up, because I just felt like, you know, she didn't always get that primary attention. So, you know, I'm not sure if that's an in-the-box answer, but that's really what's close to my heart.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And you know, thank you for sharing that. I want to thank you overall for, again, for spending the time with us. It's been a great conversation and one that I know our audience will find very insightful. Thank you, Bill.
That's great. Thanks, RJ.